welcome to Books and Arts Daily on RN, online, on air, and on the ABC Radio app. I'm Michael Williams, for the very last time. Well, no, I'll be Michael Williams for a bit longer, but I won't be on the show again next week. Michael Cathcart's coming back. He's back from Ubud Writers' Festival with an incredible lineup of authors, including Amitav Ghosh. It'll be terrific to hear what he's been up to from Monday. We did mention yesterday we hope to bring you a discussion this morning of the work and influence of Jeff Koons. Unfortunately, that conversation's had to be postponed. It will still happen with the other Michael at some point in the coming weeks. But as ever, we've got a jam-packed show of things to discuss today. We head to the coastal town of Bellbrae in Victoria, and we hear why Aboriginal artist Jenny Crompton uses seaweed and kelp in her art.
When I gather and collect, it's like I'm being told to use the seaweed, and it really is to represent the ancestors.
And we discuss the film adaptation of Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl. What has David Fincher made of those most unreliable of narrators? But first, can writers get away with just being writers in this modern publishing world? That's a taste of a track called Dead American Writers by Tired Pony. And it's hard not to think that various notorious dead American writers would find the new world of being an author a bit mysterious. Hard to picture Hemingway uploading pictures of his latest meal onto Instagram, you know, with a hashtag that says more whiskey and Marlon. Doesn't sound right. But the world of being a writer has changed. Not only do you have to go out there on the hustings, writers, festivals, bookshop events, but now as the digital world takes hold, you're expected to be your own promoter, blogging, tweeting, Facebooking and the rest of it. The life of the writer has dramatically changed, and Simone Murray is from Monash University. She's studied the realm of the digital literary sphere and its impact on the writer. Simone, welcome back to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
And now, let's go right from the top. Can a writer just be a writer anymore?
Probably not. Really, the minimum that you need to present yourself and have a platform in the digital world is a web page. But that's been true since the late 1990s. Really, there's a whole suite of things around social media that you're expected to have these days. So a Facebook account, a blog, Twitter, and more recent phenomena like Instagram and Pinterest, which are more visual phenomenon, are really part of the whole array by which you reach out to your readers and maintain a relationship.
Is this self-publishing by stealth? Does the writer have to take charge of their own promotion, their own relationship with readers in a way that they historically didn't have to?
Well, yeah, in part they do. I mean, it's partly because publishers are, as everyone knows, feeling the squeeze. And so marketing and publicity budgets are under pressure and have been for a long time. And so increasingly, the more self-publicity a voluntarily self-publicising author can do, then the happier the publishing company will be. In fact, if you've got a very established social media presence already, it's a huge boost to your chances of actually being acquired by a publishing house, because you can demonstrate and you can quantify a market. You know, I have 20,000 people looking at my blog every month. And that's quite exciting for publishers to be able to see evidence of an audience that will reduce their risk in bringing your work to market.
I thought I was going to get through the fortnight without mentioning 50 Shades of Grey, but fancy that.
No one can these days.
There is clearly a kind of symbiotic relationship between that way that an author publicizes themselves, builds a following, and that world of self-publishing. E.L. James, famously, as you say, she'd built-in readership before Random House took a gamble on it.
Yeah, there's such an interesting relationship developing between print publishing and online publishing. And E.L. James is an example of just how blurry and interdependent those two spheres have become. I mean, as is well known, she was writing Twilight fan fiction online under a different name, got a huge following, and then was picked up by a Random House subsidiary and published to global sales, as we know. But what's so interesting there is when digital publishing became a phenomenon around about the mid to late 90s, the whole idea was that it would replace print publication, that it would eclipse it. And in fact, something quite different's gone on. We're often seeing, in the case of E.L. James, someone demonstrating their viability, if you like, their marketability in the online sphere, and then having that converted into print publication. And it isn't an isolated example. I mean, Matthew Riley is probably a well-known example of self-publishing on mainstream publishing in Australia. But also Amazon, which is a champion of digital publishing, has a whole program called Amazon Encore, where they take the best digitally self-published titles, or what they deem to be the best or most marketable, and then republish them under their own imprint in print format and retail them through print retailers and bookshops. So the strange thing that's developed is it's almost as though digital publishing's become the research and development arm of the print publishing sphere, and that's really not what was predicted back in the 1990s.
But when it comes to kind of markers of whether a book is any good or a writer is a gifted writer, I mean, it's a completely different skill set, surely, to be able to sell oneself or to build a public persona that is engaging. Surely they're not kind of byproducts of being someone who writes wonderful prose.
No, and if you think that the normal personality type, if we can generalise about an author, might be fairly introverted, socially not necessarily given to performing on stages, then this kind of self-publicising probably doesn't come naturally to a lot of authors. But these debates about whether the publicity tail's wagging the literary dog, if you like, are not new. We saw this with the rise of the Writers' Festival phenomenon from the mid-1980s, the idea that some people were being published because they were good festival performers and they could get up on stage or television chat shows and give an actorly performance or read their own work in a convincing way. And these kinds of debates have now morphed into a digital sphere. And I actually think in some ways the standard kind of introverted author personality type might have an advantage with, say, blogging and Twitter, because they are at least written formats as opposed to doing TV and radio. They ought to play to the skill set of an author. Having said that, it's certainly true there is a lot of disquiet that maybe some people are being published because their social media presence is so volatile and so visible, and that may be worth more these days to a marketing and publicity team when they hold sway in editorial committee meetings.
I like your observation, though, that it isn't just a byproduct of the digital age. You know, if someone's an aspiring writer, probably the best thing they can do is rehearse being photographed wearing a fedora on the stoop of a brownstone in Brooklyn, and then, you know, the publisher's going to know they're up for everything that follows.
Well, if you're that much of a hipster, it's only going to help you. But look, celebrity authorship and performing goes way back to, say, Dickens' lecture tours of the US. Or the 19th century phenomenon.
So Mark Twain.
Mark Twain, for example, who had a huge kind of profile amongst print publications, newspapers and so on at the time. So it isn't just a child of the digital age, but its profile is changing in the digital era.
You're listening to Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Williams, and I'm talking to Simone Murray about the way the digital age is changing being an author. It's not just a kind of high culture, low culture divide, I don't think. I mean, a whole lot of writers who we think of as very kind of prestigious names, literary names, are embracing social media, Twitter in particular. Let's just hear a snippet of Canadian author Margaret Atwood. She is a big fan of Twitter. Here's what she had to say.
Well, I think Twitter is a combination of your own little radio show and a party. And there have been many other short forms in human communication. Humans don't invent anything that isn't an answer to what they want or what they fear. So it's all within this area of human communication. We're very, very chatty.
Margaret Atwood there talking to The Economist about why she uses Twitter. She has more than 500,000 Twitter followers. But maybe more importantly than that, she tweets back. She follows quite a lot of people and she really engages with that community in a way that feels organic. How rare is that?
It's pretty rare. I mean, the thing about Atwood that marks her out as the doyen of media savvy authors or digitally savvy authors is that she's not of a generation you think of as a digital native. You know, she's not a Generation Y. And yet she's enthusiastically braced Twitter with 500,000 followers now. And she's also got into a number of other digital phenomena like serial publishing with Kindle and other digital things. And she does it with great gusto, so good for her. It's true that Atwood's success is partly because she was an established brand name and has been since the 1970s, but also that she understood that Twitter encourages conversation, and the worst thing that an author moving into Twitter can do is what's called broadcasting, which is a nasty old media term according to them, which means just giving your own publicity on Twitter. It's really about the engagement, following others, interacting, and genuinely replying to people, not simply blasting people when you've got a message or a new book to promote.
Yeah, nothing worse than broadcasters. Can't abide them. They're just bad. But, you know, there have been some fabulous kind of stoushes, particularly around Twitter. Jonathan Franzen, with his trademark kind of contempt, had some withering put-downs when Salman Rushdie was active on Twitter.
He did. This is one of the points where literary authorship and Twitter really came to public prominence. Around about 2013, the Guardian newspaper in Britain published an extract from Franzen's book, The Krauss Project, which really is about something quite different. But in a one-sentence aside, in an extract that The Guardian picked up and published, he talked about feeling he expressed a disappointment when an author he admires succumbs to Twitter, with all the disdain embodied in those verbs. And created an almost immediate riposte from Salman Rushdie, who said Margaret Atwood and Joyce Carol Oates and Gary Steingart and Nathan Englander and himself were all fine with Twitter, and Jonathan Franzen should enjoy his ivory tower. So a big slap down by two literary heavyweights, which obviously the mainstream press just jumped all over.
And the best thing is Franzen didn't follow him on Twitter, so he wasn't aware of how dissed he was being.
A very large number of fake Franzen Twitter accounts grew up, which were really quite funny, I have to say. Which put some words into his mouth, but I expect that he didn't immediately hop onto Twitter himself.
I am interested in the last kind of minute or so that we've got. We spoke to Alexander McCall-Smith earlier in the week about actually publishing short fiction on Twitter, using it as an extension of his artistic practice. Do you think there's a future for that?
There's a lot of interest in it. Jennifer Egan, who won major prizes with her A Visit from the Goon Squad just a number of years ago, experimented with Twitter short fiction in a book called, or a work called Black Box that The New Yorker then published. The big debate is about whether you make a little haiku-like story within a single tweet of 140 characters, or whether you make a story in a serial format of the kind that Alexander McCall-Smith was doing, and you post installments hourly or daily. And there's some debate about which is the most effective form of Twitter. Having said that, a lot of them are then republished in print form in a way that you can read them in the correct order and keep them in one place. It gets a bit messy in a Twitter feed to work out which is the story and which is random other postings from an author.
Look, Simone, what is clear is that it is increasingly becoming an organic part of writers' lives, and it's been really terrific to have you back on the show today to talk about it.
A pleasure.
Simone Murray lectures in literary studies at Monash University. You can join the conversation, go onto the RN website, comment under this story. You can tweet us at RN Books and Arts Daily. But what I would say to you is, if you're a writer, don't. Get off the internet for crying out loud and just write your book. This is Books and Arts Daily. I'm Michael Williams.
The bush are the keepers of our secrets. As the song was when we lay.
Imagine, if you will, an arc stretching from Siberia and Alaska down through Asia all the way to us here in Australia and New Zealand. That arc traces most of our modern economic and cultural interests, but it also links our countries in a much more ancient sense. Every year, thousands of shorebirds migrate along that path, stopping along the way to refuel. But development pressures mean that the birds' crucial landing pads are under threat. For Books and Arts Daily, Matthew Crawford discovers how 20 printmaking artists are trying to get across a conservation message.
I'm Kate Gorringe-Smith, and I'm the coordinating artist of the Flyway Print Exchange.
And in this exhibition space, Kate's showing me the work of one of her 20 featured artists, Hyun Tae Lee in this case, who's from Korea.
It's a blue strip at the bottom that he's just stamped on, and then he's used letterpress to have the word birds and an arrow. And he wrote me a beautiful letter saying that it was his experience of bird watching, that you can watch the bird and watch it and watch it and watch it and watch it until it finally disappears. And that's what he just wanted. It's so simple, and it's really quirky and quite funny. And that's what I love about that one. And he also had a lovely story about how, living in South Korea, he said so many of his Northern Korean brothers want to come to South Korea, and he looks at the migratory birds, and it makes him think of their freedom and how people want to migrate as well, and how lucky the birds are to be able to move so freely.
Let's get on to the more broad purpose of the Flyaway Print Exchange. What is the project for?
It's got many purposes, but the main one would be to bring together the artists along the Flyaway, but to publicise the idea of the Flyaway and the migratory shorebirds that fly along it. Because Australia has, I think it's 36 species of migratory shorebird. One just migrates from Australia to New Zealand and back, but the others all...
Which is far enough. When you think about it, that's a long way for a bird to fly.
And for a very, very... They're very tiny, tiny little birds. Like, they weigh no more than 250-cent pieces, I think. So about 30 grams.
Gosh, and it flies all the way from Australia to New Zealand.
Yes, but similarly sized birds fly all the way from Australia up to the Arctic Circle and back every year of their adult lives because they breed up there and they overwinter down here.
So they've got a perpetual summer. They go for the northern summer, then southern summer, right?
That's it. They follow the sun.
And what's significant about the flyway, that path through Asia?
It's the path that the birds fly through. So another reason for the exhibition was to make people aware. They fly through 23 countries on their way. They stop over often on the way. Sometimes they come all the way back non-stop, which is amazing. But they mostly have to stop over and feed and rest. And I think there are still, there are also resident populations in some of the other flyaway countries. But it means that it's a global responsibility to preserve their wetland habitat, to make sure the shorebirds can keep flying.
All along that flyaway, right?
23 countries, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, if a wetland is lost in one spot...
Yeah, no, that's it, cactus. All over Red Rover.
And in 2006, that was the fate of 20,000 great knots. That's a migratory shorebird species that relied on a wetland in Korea that got, well, closed off thanks to the construction of a seawall. And when these birds landed at that site, there was nothing to eat anymore, and so 20,000 of them died. That was 20% of the world's population. And so conservation of habitat right along the flyway is crucial to the survival of all our migratory shorebird species. But what is it that artists can do to help?
Well, I think that the scientists do the most marvellous work. They can gather the data of the numbers of the birds that are travelling through an area. They can tag them so that they find out which birds are coming back to Australia and how many of them and where they're going, and to confirm their ideas of where the flyway was and what which birds travelled to which countries. They satellite tracked birds, so they actually implanted a satellite tracker in the bird's body. That was a bar-tailed godwit, which is my personal favourite. And that confirmed the story and the sort of the route of the flyway. But I think artists can have a really good role in then taking that information and bridging, taking it from the numbers to the people and turning it into a story that people will feel. I think there's a difference between knowing something and believing something, and I think it's to do with your head and your heart. And if the story can get into your heart, then I think that's what motivates people to try and change things.
And one way that Kate Gorringe-Smith here is helping to tell that story is with a feature inside this exhibition space.
So we've got one set of the prints, 20 prints on the wall, and then we sent one of each print by post up the flyway and back. So each one was posted without any kind of cover. They were just folded and they were either tied together by string or sticky tape or whatever. And they were posted. I'm in Melbourne, so I sent them to our artist in Auckland, who posted them to Singapore, who posted them to Alaska, and then they came back to Melbourne. So they've followed the path of the birds, and they're all weathered and creased, and some are torn, and they've got stamps and postmarks. And the idea was that they would really capture the sense of the distance, standing in for the birds, as it were, because you can't have the birds in the exhibition, and just show the rigours and hardships of that distance that, you know, they face every single year.
You've left it completely raw in the sense that there's, you know, stamps and tape and all kinds of stuff sort of hanging off what are actually
Beautiful artworks. Yeah,
exactly. Precious prints. That's right.
Yeah. And the idea, well, I mean, you sort of think, well, it's art, you know, but then you think, well, how precious is a bird? You know, it's a living thing. It's come down through all these. It's a miracle that they ever survived any of these trips or this distance at all. So, you know, you have an artwork or you have a bird, and which is more precious? That's a question I can't answer.
Well, you're the coordinating artist of the Flyaway Print Exchange, which means that you have a work in it.
I do.
So please take me to it.
Here it is. This way.
Okay.
Okay, so mine is, if you were here, you'd see it's got just like a band of dark blue with a paler band of pale blue across it, arcing across it. And it's based on a 19th century map of the sky. So it's a map of the Milky Way.
So kind of that globe flattened out on the paper,
yes,
with all the sort of the map, the lines,
yeah,
of the map on there. Yeah.
It's, and it's got sort of constellations mapped out and things. But if you look closely, among all the stars that are mapped out, you've actually got the birds flying across through the sky, because the idea is just that they've always been there. So, you know, those old constellation maps that have the zodiac signs on them. So I was thinking they should really all be shorebirds, all the zodiac signs. So,
yeah. Well, it's a beautifully evocative piece of work. How did you make it?
It's actually an etching, and the blue out of which I've cut the stars and the shorebirds. So they're cut out in white. So that's one liner cut. Then the arc of a paler blue across it, which marks the path of the Milky Way, that's a second liner cut. And then you have to look quite closely, but then there's sort of the black circles that divide the quadrants of the sky and mark out the constellations. That's an etching. So it's two liner cuts and one etching all bung together.
And if you go along to the RN website and follow through to Books and Arts Daily, you can see some images of these prints. And what's Kate hoping that this project will achieve?
I really want everybody to know about the Flyaway. I think that's would be my ultimate goal. I was growing up when there was the big push for everybody to learn about whales. Whales were being killed and were disappearing, and there was a huge, I can't even remember how we found out about it, but all of a sudden everybody knew about whales and the story and the wonders of how they communicate and that they're such complicated animals. And now whenever there's, like, we all hate that whales are killed, and we all want to preserve them. And I think it's an international love now of these creatures, which once probably, you know, living in the deep, people just didn't know about. And I think the story of the Flyaway and the birds that make these epic journeys every year is just as inspiring. Not that it's a competition, of course, but I think it's just as inspiring as the story of the whales. You can have the best of intentions with shorebirds, but it does take all of those flyaway countries joined together to save the shorebirds and to make their path safe and livable and usable. So the more people who know about the flyaway story, who feel passionately about it, who start looking at shorebirds, because they're not dazzling birds, but once you look closely at them, they're very, very beautiful. And I think wherever we have the exhibition, there's the potential for workshops, for people to tell the story, for people to become engaged with it.
And if you want to get engaged with the shorebird story, Adelaide's the place to be right now, pretty much only in that respect. The Flyaway Print Exchange opened during the recent Oz Asia Festival, and it's still showing at the Space Theatre Foyer until Sunday, the 12th of October. That was Kate Gorringe-Smith, contradicting the theory that nothing rhymes with orange. She's the coordinating artist, and she was speaking to Matthew Crawford. Kate is also taking the exhibition to the Hong Kong Wetland Park from November and to Moreton Bay in Queensland from the middle of next year, and she's organising other engagements right along the Flyaway in New Zealand and in Alaska. You'll find links and pictures on the Books and Arts page at the RN website. I'm Michael Williams, and you're listening to Books and Arts Daily on RN, online, and on the ABC radio app. Anyway, coming up, an Aboriginal artist who's crazy about seaweed. When she was 41, the Victorian artist Jenny Crompton discovered she was Aboriginal after a distant relative finished the family tree. Jenny learnt that her great-grandmother was from the Wadwurrung tribe. Their country sweeps west from Melbourne, through Geelong to the Bellarine Peninsula and north to Ballarat. 5 years after finding out she had Aboriginal heritage, Jenny Crompton's now won Victoria's biggest Indigenous art prize, the $30,000 Dedley Art Award. Jenny's home studio is on Wadwurrung country in the coastal town of Bellbrae. Our own Georgia Moody went to meet Jenny there to learn about her art and the rather unusual raw material that she works with, seaweed and kelp.
Jenny, I think I saw some kelp sitting in a bucket outside.
You did? You want to go and have a look?
Yeah,
come on. Not?
It'll be really stinky by now. Kelp seems to last a bit longer.
I was going to ask about that. Does it ever... does it smell?
I left a bucket and I forgot that I'd had it, and I think it was about 2 months. And by the time I got to it, I couldn't believe the stench. I threw it out down quite a while away from the house, and the smell just stayed around for about a week. My partner was furious with me. So here I've got big buckets. There hasn't been much kelp coming in from the beach, so it's just small snippings, but you can see that that's gone completely mouldy, so that means it's been on the beach and been wet for a long, long period. Here we've got maybe a bit fresher.
Oh, yeah, that's like orangey-greeny colour.
I'd say it's like an ochre, a yellow ochre. Then you'll get a bit over here, which is like a sort of sienna brown almost colour. It's gone a bit slimy.
And it's from this slimy, smelly, even mouldy seaweed that Jenny creates her beautifully intricate, elegant sculptural works. She won the Dedley Art Award for a piece called Gathering at Goddicott, a striking work made entirely of local seaweed with just a tiny bit of glue to keep it all together.
There are about 25 pieces in the gathering, and Goddicott is the Wadwurrung word for point addis. They're based on a tapping stick or even a message stick shape, and in them I think there are around about 10 to 15 different varieties of seaweeds that have been used. So some are about a metre and a half long and others might be about 50 centimetres long. They're suspended from the ceiling. The seaweeds have been collected and gathered from Goddicott, Point Addis, and I bring the seaweeds back, sort them out, clean them all, and then there's hours and hours of dissecting the plants. I wanted to create meshes, weave-like textures, so certain seaweeds didn't work. It was only through trial and error what seaweeds would work. There's different shades of pinks, oranges, and like a really sort of purpley colour, but they're all natural colours, and the pinks are a very, very hard seaweed to work with. It's like working with wet tissue paper.
There are 25 of these tapping stick-shaped forms. What do they represent?
They represent the clans of the Wadwurrung, and where I have gathered from, high above on the cliff face, is a midden. A midden is a place where Aboriginal people would gather, like their kitchen almost, where they would gather, collect and bring the food up and make fires and sit there and eat. So I imagine that, you know, over thousands and thousands of years that the Wadwurrung at different times of the year would come and sit up there and collect their food, and yeah, different clans frequenting that area at different times. And so it's a... to represent a clan of the Wadwurrung.
And off we go. Beautiful rosellas.
After the tour of her studio, we head to Goddicott, or Point Addis, so Jenny can show me the beach where she collects her seaweed and kelp, as well as the local Koori culture walk.
So that's the start of the walk.
Yeah.
Down here. But there's a little bit of information to do with the Wadwurrung people.
Mm-hmm.
Little sign up there. So where are we? So in 1836 there were approximately 700 members of the clan. By 1853 there were only 35. This rapid decline is attributed to the introduction of disease, massacres and the loss of food sources due to European settlement. In there is one of my ancestors in that last 35, and that makes you think, doesn't it? It's that I'm really lucky to be here.
And so, Jenny, this is the beach where you come to collect seaweed?
This is it. And we're just approaching. We're about to see the water. Look at that. Oh, my God, look how much... Oh, my God, there's seaweed. There's just seaweed everywhere. You can come down here, especially around full moon. You won't find any seaweed because the tides are so big. But I can't believe how much seaweed there is. Look at me, I'm starting to get... I didn't bring my bags. It was almost like when I gather and collect, it's like I'm being told to use the seaweed. And it really is to represent the ancestors. It's the spirits that I feel are down here that are present for me. When I gather, it sort of becomes still. It's like I feel a vibration and I go with it.
Jenny, you only found out you were Aboriginal about 5 years ago in your early 40s. How did you find out?
A really distant relative finished the family tree, and my father had died about 10 years ago, so the Aboriginal heritage comes from my father's side. The family tree was passed around after the last of my grandmother's siblings had died. Now, my father never mentioned to me that he had Aboriginal heritage, and my grandmother never mentioned anything. So it really came as a shock, because when my father did die, I was questioning, was I Aboriginal? Have I got Aboriginal heritage? You know, a lot of questions have been answered for me because of the artwork I do. After I did find out, I went back through years and years and years of paintings and sculpture, and I just went, wow, fancy that.
And why is that? Because your art was always exploring ideas of Aboriginal identity?
Not so much Aboriginal identity, Indigenous cultures, I'd say. I did a sculpture, it'd be about 18 years ago, I think now, and it was one of the biggest sculptures that I did, and it's when I first started doing art, and that sculpture's based on Papua New Guinean X-ray drawings. Straight after that, I remember I did a commission for a, you know, groovy cafe somewhere, and it was just stick figures dancing, and I look back at this old piece of work and it looks like two figures off a bark painting. And then I did a lot of travelling in Indonesia. I learnt Batak wood carving, and I'd go back to Sumatra and I met a man there called Harry, and with him I used to go and collect and gather from different areas in Indonesia at different remote islands, and then I'd come back with Harry and we'd wood carve together. I've always been drawn to Indigenous cultures, their tribal art.
So what was your reaction when you found out that you have Aboriginal heritage?
Yeah, look, it hasn't been... I mean, 5 years in the scheme of things is not a long time, and really I've got so much to learn. And some questions have been answered, but now there seems to be more questions. As an artist, I'm so glad that this relative did the family tree for me, because it sort of has allowed me to follow a different path with art and be a bit more comfortable with selecting what I do tend to work with. Trusting my instinct when ideas come, that they are true and that they're not to be questioned. It's a different listening than how I used to listen to myself. When I do get these strong influences, I jump on them and move with them, where before I would really be questioning it. I don't do that as much, I guess.
Tell me what you know about your grandmother and where she was from.
Well, my grandmother, I think she might have known that she was Aboriginal, but it was never, ever, ever said. Another distant relative, and this is my grandmother's sister's daughter, they knew, and when they went to discuss it with their mother, she said it was like opening up World War III. It was not to be talked about. My great-grandmother, her father was Scottish, and he had relations with an Aboriginal woman, and he basically went straight back to Scotland after my great-grandmother was born, and my great-grandmother lived with her mother on the camp or the reserve. And when she turned into her teens, her uncle removed her from her mother and took her under his wing. They sent her back to Scotland because the uncle thought that she should meet her father. Again, she was disowned by her father and sent back again. So I think that being disowned once, but then being disowned twice, that to forget about being Aboriginal was much easier than standing up for it. So there is a history of it having to stay hidden, and I'm just really lucky that I know now a bit more of the history.
I know that you used to live in Melbourne. Did you make a conscious decision to move here to be on country?
Yeah, well, I used to come down here 20 years ago, and Point Addis, Goddicott, always has had a special place for me, and we used to jump in the Volkswagen and come down surfing. And when I did find out, we'd been living in Footscray for about 15 years, and my poor old dog died, and it was just time to move. And the area that I wanted to live was Bellbrae. It wasn't Torquay, it wasn't Anglesey. There's something special about down here, and I'm 5 minutes now from Point Addis, and it just so happens because I work with seaweed. I mean, it's all a bit too much of a coincidence, I think. So, yes, it was a very conscious decision, yeah.
In the 5 years since you got, I guess, confirmation of your Aboriginal heritage, how have you gone about connecting with your Wadawurrung heritage and culture?
It's actually through the art. That's how I feel connected, by doing my art. I do a lot of reading. I finally met the elders of the Wadawurrung at Rainbow Serpent Festival about a year ago, and I danced with the ladies. We did Welcome to Country, and that was absolutely brilliant. And, I only met them about a year ago, and then after winning the award on the night at Ballarat, I met some more elders of the Wadawurrung. So it's been a very slow process, and I think, you know, it's still raising questions for me. Connections with people take time, I think, and it will come. I've got to go up for a talk at Ballarat, so I'm going to call into the Wadawurrung Co-op and go and say hello to Uncle Brian and just, you know, say I'm here, I'm around. Yeah, but just slowly, slowly.
That's Aboriginal artist Jenny Crompton speaking to Georgia Moody. Her work, Gathering at Goddicott, is on display at the Art Gallery of Ballarat as part of the Victorian Indigenous Art Awards until the 5th of October. That's this Sunday. There's a link on our website. You're listening to Books and Arts Daily. I'm Michael Williams.
We asked radio producers from around the world to choose their favourite pieces of audio.
It's our Radio Yak series. On Soundproof, we're going deep into the world of soundscapes.
And on Radiotonic, cockroaches, poetry, and a little bit of fun.
Say it slow!
Pot eight toes.
Good God, woman, you've just told me! How can I give her a clue? She's got it!
Well, I don't know!
Radiotonic with me, Jesse Cox.
And Soundproof with me, Miyuki Okiranta. Download now from the RN homepage.
But coming up now, we join Gone Girl in making the transition from book to film.
Nick Dunn, you're probably the most hated man in America right now. Did you kill your wife, Nick?
Everyone told us and told us marriage is hard work. Not for me and Nick.
As you all know, my wife, Amy Elliott Dunn, disappeared 3 days ago. I had nothing to do with the disappearance of my wife. I have nothing to hide.
Most summers there's a book that does the rounds that you seemingly can't get away from. Public transport, on the beaches, everyone's reading their own well-thumbed copy. And a couple of years ago, it was Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, one of those books that was ubiquitous, a kind of rollicking thriller in many ways, but one that really transcended its kind of genre confines. And it's a film now. Gillian Flynn's written the screenplay to the film adaptation. David Fincher's directed. It stars Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike. And I'm joined in the studio by broadcaster and film critic Thomas Caldwell and writer and reviewer Alicia Sometimes. They've both read the book and seen the movie, which is showing nationally at the moment. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Michael. Good
morning.
Thank
you.
Now, this is a twisty-turny story in whatever medium it appears. We are going to try and pay respect to the 8 people listening who haven't actually read the book, and we're going to really try and studiously avoid giving anything away. You both up for that challenge?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
So let's start at the end. I can't believe at the twist. No, we're not going to do that. I'm going to ask Alicia, can you try and set up the plot in kind of broad brush strokes for our listeners?
Well, the novel is beautifully set up with a he said, she said. So we've got Nick Dunn's story told through his eyes about his life with his wife, and it's coming up to their 5th year anniversary. And then we've got Amy's story, which is told in diary form. And they're a little conflicting at times. And they were both writers who are currently unemployed. They've moved to a small town so Nick could have been with his ailing mother who since passed away. And Nick has a sister and they own a bar. And it is about their marriage and how, they're both relating to each other. And each year, Amy does some wonderful trickery on her husband, I think, by setting a treasure hunt trail for him to follow to show her love, which is really, really loaded each year as far as see how much you love me by all the clues that you can guess and what you do. And it's just an interesting tale about what people do to each other in marriages.
I choose to believe it's in no way representative of wider marriages. Please let me believe that this marriage is somewhat remarkable. But, your point to the he said, she said, it is a spectacularly literary device to cut between two voices, to have a diary on the one hand that's set in the past and then a kind of present-day narrative that sits on the shoulder of the protagonist. Thomas, were you a fan of the book?
Yeah, I was. I had a rare experience with the book where maybe for the first half of it I was enjoying it, but there are certain elements that were really frustrating me, in particular the Amy diary scenes. I found the way of the writing style almost infantile, really twee, really annoying. And then there's suddenly a point where I realised that is the point. And oh my goodness, this book is smarter than I am. And I found that really exhilarating, that I had been completely fooled. I found that quite exciting. So I ended up loving the book. Like, I sort of laughed out loud in glee at its wickedness at points, which is a rare experience for me when reading. And I think the film does an extraordinary job using film style to replicate some of that literary style. So those diary scenes, which are really important, and it's clear there's something unreliable going on there and we're getting an idealised version of the past, the film does that with film style beautifully. So those scenes are really warmly lit. There's this saccharine music. The acting and the dialogue is just a little bit cheesy. And Rosamund Pike does this amazing performance as this kind of ethereal, angelic, kind of breathy, almost floating on air performance of this idealised woman.
It's a really interesting point. David Fincher is the director who's taken on the task, and you both touched upon the way in which the story is one of men and women, and in many ways, men versus women. Mm-hmm. And Fincher's a filmmaker who's been seen as problematic in the past for his depiction of women. Can you talk about how gender plays out in his adaptation of Gone Girl, Alicia?
I think, Thomas, you picked it really well there, saying that Rosamund Pike played this ethereal woman. You can tell Nick is a very sort of hometown boy who kind of wants that idealised woman, that idealised life. There's a touch of commercialism to him. There's a touch of him not taking responsibility or being in touch with his feelings. That's almost the cliche man, in films or books, that this guy is so out of touch. And I think that the relationship and the play between the two starts to feel, at the beginning it seems one thing and it turns out to be so much different.
You talk about the character of Nick. It's worth noting he is played in what I think is a genius moment of casting by Ben Affleck, who plays on his kind of smug all-American persona. But, there's even a line accusing him of having an untrustworthy chin. And a recurring refrain in the film is he has to cover that famous dimple in his chin if he wants to be believed.
Yes.
Did that
genius casting. Yeah. I mean, this is a really good example of taking the baggage of that performer and using it for the character of the film. I mean, a big part of this character that Ben Affleck plays is people can't help but hate him and dislike his smug, arrogant, smarmy face. And Ben Affleck has all this baggage for, whether he deserves it or not. I mean, maybe once he did in the past. I think he's actually proved himself as a filmmaker and an actor since, but he does have enormous baggage as a sort of smug, pretty boy actor who has it all. And that's kind of the role of this character. And this keeping up appearances theme is a really big one in film and book, that we both have these idealised versions of ourselves that we try to sell to our loved ones, and we expect our loved ones to maintain this idealised version of themselves. And when that facade starts to crumble, just like the American Dream did at post-GFC, which is also in the background of both texts, we start to get very angry and resentful towards the other.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that kind of post-GFC theme as it runs through the book and the film. How important is that idea that dream that they thought they were living is never attainable?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think I don't think it has anything to do with the GFC in the background, although it's great that that was prominent in both. I think it's indicative of any time that we live in that we try to present appearances, that sometimes we don't go in depth and look at ourselves, that our relationships seem to be one thing. And sometimes we just don't want to know the other person. We want to see them as perfect. And I think that the monetary problems have run throughout history, that you have those clashes that so I think it was good, and it placed it in a time. And
I think the GFC was the result of a massive lie that collapsed. I mean the myth of the financial system and the strength of the housing market.
Yeah, it's symbolic, I guess.
Yeah, so I think that kind of shattering, I think, nicely symbolises the shattering of the expectations we have towards love and marriage and gender roles.
Well, I want to come back to that gender roles thing, because one of the really memorable scenes in the book can be roughly summed up as Amy's cool girl speech, where she talks.
It's a moment.
Such a lovely piece of writing. Explain that to us,
Thomas. Well, there's an amazing scene where Amy deconstructs this idea of the cool girl as this idealised woman. And I suppose it builds on centuries of idealised depictions of women, from the muse. We talked a lot about the manic pixie dream girl at one point. And now this idea of, or the it girl, now the cool girl is a girl who's sort of hot, but also likes to hang out with the guys. Think of the Cameron Diaz character in There's Something About Mary. I think that's a really good early incarnation of the cool girl, and that women want to play up to this sort of fun-loving but sexually available, down-to-earth but also gorgeous persona, because that's what men want.
And I think that, the interesting twist on this, I've heard that speech before, but I think she takes it in a unique way by saying every guy has a different dream girl.
There's
and
all the variations.
Yeah, the variations of if you like poker, well, she likes poker too, and so forth. But I think it's women have these idealised visions of men too, that we want them to be certain things. We just want another person to provide and be all that perfect person and give us love and companionship and be funny. And no one can live up to this.
Well,
no
I mean,
one.
Some of us can, but it's really exhausting. It's a burden.
That's right.
It doesn't come easy.
You do it well. Yeah.
No, thanks.
You make it look easy.
You're listening to Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Williams, and I'm talking to Thomas Caldwell and Alicia Sometimes about David Fincher's adaptation of Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, which is on in cinemas at the moment. The cool girl speech is treated in a particular way in the film, and I want to kind of dwell on that, because one of the themes of the book and the film is misogyny and kind of innate misogyny. And there are a couple of scenes that, in my memory, were bigger in the book than they were in the film. This could be a false memory, but Nick, for example, has a father with quite advanced dementia, and one of the ways the dementia expresses itself is in these kind of tirades against women and these quite violent misogynist tirades. It's there in the film, but it seems downplayed to me. Is that
in the background?
Yeah, I had the same feeling. As much as I love the film, and I think Fincher's master of style in his social critique is wonderfully dark and biting, I think what the film lacks is some of that darker investigation into misogyny. I think the Nick character is slightly softened in the film.
Yeah, he's more likable.
He is more likable, yeah. We get more of a sense in the book of how angry, selfish and how childishly misogynist he is. And because the film by necessity is going to have to condense stuff, we do lose a lot of the cool girl speech, which I think is a pity. And we lose some of those nuances to the point that I think the film has almost there's almost a danger of it being misinterpreted by people to be arguing something
for it. Yeah.
That it really...
Fincher's no stranger to that, obviously.
Well, it reminded me of Fight Club. Yeah. Now, Fight Club is also a dark social satire, but some people took it very literally. I mean, Fight Club is looking at how kind of men's groups and men's rights movements, you know, sort of men hanging around, is something that ultimately is very violent and ends up in acts of terrorism. I mean, Fight Club is a film that wouldn't have been made post 9/11, for example. And people, instead of seeing the critique in Fight Club of masculinity, they kind of took on board the actions. Now, I reckon there's a danger that some people with a kind of very simplistic way of responding to texts might get a dangerous message from Gone Girl as well. And I don't want to speak too much about that because it will result in a rather big spoiler.
Yeah, and Ben Affleck, or the Nick in the film, constantly says little tiny remarks about women. Oh, women do that and so forth.
I'm tired of being judged by women, I think.
That's right. Yeah. But I just want to say really quickly that both in the book and the film, I find the sister two-dimensional. I didn't like her.
Oh, really? I thought she's played, the character Margot is played in the film by Carrie Coon, I think. And I enjoyed her performance as a humanising one, but it did, she was there to be an uncomplicated character in a film full of complicated characters, I think.
Yeah, I think maybe the actress was amazing, but I just think the character was very problematic.
I kind of see what you're saying upon reflection, but I think it's an important character to counterbalance some of the other representations of femininity in the film as well.
Look, in our last minute or so, one of the contrasts that really struck me was I found the film much funnier than the book. The book is really grim, whereas the film plays the kind of moments of high camp for comedic effect, I think. Did you?
I think the film massages out the humour a lot better and makes it a lot more accessible. I mean, I did get the humour in the book. Like I said, when I finished this book, I actually laughed out loud at its audacity and wickedness. But I think the film, it's more consistently funny, and the film really beautifully... Yeah, brings out some of those comedic moments.
Especially the visual jokes. But I'd love you to say massages out anything. That sounds great.
I'd rather you didn't. I feel very uncomfortable.
Kind of works with this text.
Look, thank you both so much for coming in and joining me in this conversation today. I think we're clear we're all endorsing film and book alike.
Yes,
absolutely,
both.
Yeah.
That is wonderful to hear. If you're interested in more of a discussion of the way gender plays out in the film, Jason DeRosso and the Final Cut team had an interesting discussion about it. There's a transcript up on the RN homepage, but spoilerphobes beware. They've been far less discreet than we have today. I've been speaking with Alicia Sometimes and Thomas Caldwell. Thank you to you both.
Thanks,
Thank
Michael.
Thank you.
Gone Girl, directed by David Fincher, is on national release now, and the novel by Gillian Flynn is published by Orion. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and I'm Michael Williams. And this is also my last chance to mention that Books and Arts is headed to the Regional Arts Conference in Kalgoorlie on October 17. We're going to be chairing an important panel discussion at the conference on the big questions facing regional arts in this country. If there's a question you'd like to ask our panel, including the Federal Arts Minister George Brandis, then make sure you head to the Regional Arts Summit tab on the Books and Arts website and find out how you can submit your question and have it included in the summit and then broadcast right here on the show. We're coming up to the 3 a.m. news, then Margaret Throsby is talking to a little-known memoirist called Julia Gillard. That's going to be well worth listening to. I've had a ball this fortnight. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Good night.
The Prime Minister departs today on Australia's biggest ever trade mission to North Asia.
And before the end of the year, expects to sign a free trade deal with Australia's biggest trading partner, China. Free trade deals are all the rage, but what have been the benefits to Australia?
We are disappointed that we couldn't get sugar into this deal.
That's Rear Vision. China, Australia and free trade agreements. Download or stream this Rear Vision from the RN website.